There's a big question in this passage out of Habakkuk, and as a matter of fact, in all of the Old Testament book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk wants to know, God, what are you going to do about evil? Because there are evil people everywhere. There are evil people among your people. There are evil people outside of your people, and they seem to have everything pretty great. They seem to keep living on and being prosperous. So what are you going to do about that? I thought you were a God who cared about these things. And we talked last week about how God's initial answer to Habakkuk was, well, when my people are evil, I'll send the Babylonians. And Habakkuk said, well, that's all well and good. We just read that portion here. That's all well and good, but they're even worse. What are you going to do about them? How can you judge your people by an even worse people? And God starts off by telling him, watch and be amazed. Because what I'm about to do is something that you wouldn't have expected. Frankly, it's something that you probably can't even understand. And so last week we talked about how there are all these places in our lives where we've got things that hurt in one way or another, things that are unjust, that aren't right, and how God invites us to hang a sign on those places that says, God at work. Recognizing that we're not always big enough to take in what he's doing in the moment. I think each one of us, we could stop and we can look back at our own history, in our own lives, and we can say, you know what? I didn't recognize it then, but that trial, that difficult thing was building something in me that was bigger and better than I ever thought could come out of that. But the main question is still out there in some ways. God, what are you going to do about these wicked people? Are you just going to let wickedness thrive forever in your world? And God says, no, I'm going to do something more about that. See, we see those who profit when others lose. Those who take from the weak. We see thieves, CEOs with golden parachutes, and we wonder, what's God going to do about them? We see those whose wickedness makes them seemingly safe and secure. Despots who rule their countries for their own benefit while oppressing their people. What will God do about them? We see those who seemingly gain honor and good reputation for themselves through wickedness. Those who brag about not getting caught. Those who game the system and advance because of it. What's God going to do about them? We see those who take advantage of the people around them, who use people to get what they want and then they discard them. That's what Me Too at its best is all about, isn't it? You shouldn't get to take advantage of others just because you have power in one way or another. What will God do about people who prey on others? By the way, all of these questions that I'm asking here, they're pulled right out of verses 6 to 17 here. God supplies them. God's a funny guy, you know that? He's not really a guy, he's God, but he's unusual and he's different in that when you accuse him of something, he says, well, what about X, Y, and Z as well? Aren't you going to accuse me of that too? Jesus is constantly turning people's expectations around in the same way. See, God is not afraid of our questions. God invites prayer that wrestles with him over the things that we care about and over the things that he cares about. Well, first of all, God says, hey, before I start answering your question about what I'm going to do about wickedness in the world, I need to give you a warning. I need to give you a warning. And it's don't become like them. Don't become like the wicked. Now, on the one hand, duh, right? It's like, thanks, God. That's really helpful for me. But actually, God needs to remind us. Because I think we see the wicked prosper, and the temptation is to prosper in the same way, isn't it? We see, well, they got away with it, so maybe I can too. We see, well, you know, that's just the way the world works these days. If you want to make your way ahead, you got to bribe the officials. You got to become corrupt yourselves. You look out and you see, I mean, this is exactly what's at play, I think, in the impeachment process in D.C. right now. You see that one side says, they're so bad, in order to deal with them, we've got to break the rules. And the other side says, well, they're breaking the rules, so we're going to break them right back. See, at heart, we're all children, aren't we? You hit me, I'm going to hit you back. And God wants to warn us, you need to resist that natural impulse in you because it doesn't come from me. It comes from sin. When you look out and you see that the world seems to favor at one time or another, or maybe at most times or even at all times, the world seems to favor the people without a conscience, you need to remember that that's not how I called you to live. I am making a new world. So are you going to be part of that new world or the old one? Because your actions will tell the tale. Are you looking for the new world or the old one? Because what we do will show it. This is what God tells Habakkuk in chapter 2, starting here in verse 4. He says, see, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright. He says, the wicked, Babylon in this context, they are puffed up. They're thinking, I'm getting everything I want. Everything is going my way. And so they continue doing what they've always done because they feel like it's going to continue working out for them. But, while the enemy is puffed up and his desires are not upright, the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. If you take a look at the book of Hebrews in chapter 11, it's the Faith Hall of Fame, and we've come to it a few times over the last several weeks, but it gives a definition of faith right here at the very beginning. Hebrews 11:1 says, now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. Right? If we had something already, faith wouldn't be necessary. If the world was already the way that God intends to make it one day, we wouldn't need faith. But faith is assurance about what we hope for, that thing that's not here yet, but we believe is coming one day. It's confidence about things that we don't see. Sometimes it feels like we're blind in this life, doesn't it? God, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what's next. I don't know why it should be the way that it is. I don't know any of this. I feel blind. But I'm going to wait on you. God says, hey, all that I'm talking about, judging the wicked, making good in the world, here's what he says about it. He says, the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end. It will not prove false. Though it lingers, wait for it. It will certainly come, and it will not delay. I hope that there's something reassuring about that for all of us, to know that God has a date in mind. You know, I do weddings as a pastor sometimes, and the wedding date is sometimes hard to nail down. When are we going to do this? When are we going to make it all happen? When's the caterer going to be available? And when's the venue going to be open to us? But God's already set the date. And it's on its way. And even when it feels like, oh, it's taking so long to get here, he says, wait for it. It's not delaying in any way, shape, or form. Every day brings us closer. And there's something hopeful about that. So God says, first of all, before we talk about how I'm going to deal with wickedness in the world, you need to remember not to compromise with it in the meantime. To wait in faith and say, even though I don't have it yet, even though I don't understand all of the answers, and even though I am hurting and waiting for the day when God makes it right. The right way to wait is in faith, saying God is going to do it at just the right time. He is not going to delay. And I need to make sure not to join forces with wickedness in the world while I wait, no matter how tempting it may be. But then God starts to talk to Habakkuk and say, here is a glimpse of what I'm doing. Here's a glimpse of why I tolerate these things for a time. See, God tells Habakkuk, I am going to judge the wicked by means of their wickedness. Do you catch what that means there? Let me say it again. God says to Habakkuk, I am going to make the wicked break on their own wickedness. They're going to keep doing all of this stuff, and one day it's going to find them out and visit them. And the same things that they have done to everyone else are naturally going to come around and happen to them. And he gives us four examples in chapter 2. And they all start with, woe to him. Woe to him, he says, first of all, starting in verse 6. Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your creditors suddenly arise? Will not they wake up and make you tremble? And then you will become their prey. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. You have shed human blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. He says, those who steal will in turn be stolen from. That's how it works. Think about this in the context of ancient Babylon, going around conquering people. Are conquered people happy? No. Are conquered people going to sit still forever when the oppressor keeps on oppressing them? No. One day they will rise up and they'll say, as you have done to us, so we will do to you. Because that's the pattern in this world. Stealing begets stealing begets stealing. Conquering begets conquering begets conquering. And on and on and on. God says, I won't even have to lift a finger because wickedness contains its own destruction. He says next, starting in verse 9, woe to him who builds his house by unjust gain, setting his nest on high to escape the clutches of ruin. You've plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. And the stones of your wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. He says, if you take your plundered goods and you make a safe place for yourself out of them, they will cry out against you. Your guilt will be the thing that you're living in. And one day, it's going to visit you too. People will treat you the way you have treated them. See, those who build security out of oppression will find that security is false. We see it play out over and over again in our world, don't we? Empires rise and fall. Dictators come and they go, and often they go on the gallows, don't they? Because when you build your security out of taking other people's security away, eventually they're going to act in kind and give it right back to you. The third woe. He says, woe to him, in verse 12, who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town by injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire, that the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. There's a lot in this verse. And he starts off by saying that those who gain honor and reputation, those who cause others to fear them through their wickedness, will find that that fear and that honor is empty at the end of the day. Your glory is temporary. That's what God means when he says here, the people's labor is only fuel for the fire. Because once it's burned up, it's no good anymore. It's worthless. He says, whatever you build for yourselves out of your wickedness is going to get burned up in the fire. and it'll be gone, just like that. You may not even see it coming, know it's coming. And then God gives us a hint of why he's doing it all this way. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. As opposed to your honor and glory, God will have his honor and glory. Hold on to that. We're going to come back in just a minute. Finally, the fourth woe. Woe to him, verse 15, who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it's your turn. Drink and let your nakedness be exposed. This maybe speaks to us all the more loudly in these days with all of these different people in the news for the way they have sexually exploited others. Bill Cosby maybe comes to mind. You thought, with whatever resource you had, whether it was power or trickery or anything else, you thought that you could take advantage of your neighbor and get out of them whatever you had wanted. And by taking from them whatever you wanted, you humiliated them. You took away their honor. You left them with only shame. But it's going to turn around. Harvey Weinstein, right? How long did he take people's dignity away from them? But now his is gone, isn't it? Turnabout is fair play in our world. And what he did to others has been visited on him. Those who take advantage of others will be exposed, God tells us here. See, God will judge the wicked by means of their wickedness. That's part of why God says, don't live like them. You live by faith, because their world is going to fall apart. It's only a matter of time. It won't last forever. It won't endure. Don't live like them. Now, of course, we need to step back for just a moment and recognize that God isn't just speaking to evil Babylon, is he? He's speaking about all of sin everywhere. He's speaking about what you and I can so easily become, what we have too often been. The woes that God speaks here, we ought to hear echo in our own lives. And they ought to drive us back to confession, back to trusting in God for our forgiveness. Saying, but for the grace of God, that's me too. But thankfully, God has given grace to his people. You know, we mentioned at the beginning that faith is the right way for us to live. And no one exemplified that more than Jesus Christ. Now, we might say he's kind of a cheater, because he knew who he was, and he knew what he was doing, and he knew what God was about to do, and he had all of the divine resources available to him, right? Sometimes it feels good to call Jesus a cheater. He's not, though. He's not. Because he was human just like us in every single way. And even if he did know what was coming, it didn't make it hurt any less while he was waiting, did it? Going to the cross wasn't less painful for Jesus. Maybe it was more painful, because where you and I might even be able to identify with the thief crucified next to him who said, hey, you insulting Jesus, be quiet, because we're getting what we deserve. We belong on the cross, but he doesn't. Have you ever been unjustly accused? So have any of you ever driven out of the Mary's Vineyard parking lot onto 198? Anyone here ever done that? You know, and you're trying to get onto 198 going east towards the mountain. Now, if you're paying attention like me, and you're righteous like me, you know that the right lane is right turn only, and the left lane is straight or left. And then someday when you're going, I know someone's shouting, preach it. I'm worried that this is the most important part of the sermon. But I get in that left lane and I start going straight, right? And I know what I'm doing. And someone in the right lane starts honking at me. What are you doing? Get out of the way. And I say, I am unjustly accused. I'm doing the right thing here. And man, it burns in me. You guys are laughing, but it does. It burns in me. I want you to pull over and I want to explain to you all the ways that you're wrong and I'm right. Now imagine you're Jesus Christ going to the cross. The book of Isaiah says that like a lamb before its shearers is silent, so was he. Man, if I was going to the cross, everyone would hear about it. This is so unjust. I just need you all to know the kind of man that I am. I don't deserve this. You all deserve this. I mean, we think that the hard thing for Jesus was just that it hurt. But I wonder if the hardest part wasn't keeping silent. And then saying, above all things, Father, forgive them. They don't get it. It's hard to be a person of faith, isn't it? Let's be honest about it. Because I think sometimes as Christians, we hear faith and we just start nodding our heads, right? Of course. Faith, Jesus, God, the Bible. One of those is the answer. Just do it. But sometimes it burns. A hot, white hot fire in our soul. God tells us, if you're going to live in this world, the right way to deal with evil in your own life is to be a person of faith. Following the example of Jesus Christ. He says, the second thing you need to know is that I'm not going to let evil go unpunished forever. As a matter of fact, almost everyone who does evil will reap what they sow in this life. And if they don't get it in this life, they're for sure getting it in the next. God will not let evil go unpunished. He loves us too much to pretend that what we do can just be winked at. We are too significant for him to say, oh, I don't care about all of that stuff. That's not love. That's not love. But there's one other thing. God says that evil's not going to have the last word. Who's going to have the last word? I love the end of chapter 2 here. It talks a little bit about idols. Says, you know, idols are pretty dumb and pitiful and they don't do anything. But then it ends this way. Verse 20, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. I love God. I love him. I love what he has done for me. I love how good he is to me. But you know what? If I never existed, he would still be good. I think that's part of what this last verse points us toward. He is worthy for who he is, not primarily for how he treats me. You get the difference there? I think sometimes we get stuck on, it's really all about me in the end, right? Yeah, God, bring on the love. Let me have more and more. Bless me, God. But he ends and he says, when God deals with evil, the Lord is in his holy temple, the place that tells us who he is. Let all the earth be silent before him. Because he is all wise. Who's going to stand up and say, well, you should have done it this way, God? Because he is all good. He's holy in every way. Who's going to stand up and say, yeah, well, I did this, but you did that? You can't, because he always does it right. really irritatingly sometimes. But that's who he is. Who's going to stand up before him and tell him they knew a better way to go? Because here is the outcome. God says in the second woe, "Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed, establishes a town by injustice. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire? All that you do apart from God burned up at the end." Remember the Tower of Babel all the way back in the book of Genesis? Remember how they said, "Let's build for ourselves a tower that reaches to heaven." That wasn't an accident. They weren't just saying a really tall tower. The idea was, let's restore for ourselves what we lost from the garden. That's the question that drives the entire book of Genesis, but especially the first 11 chapters. How do we get back to Eden? And people in Genesis chapter 11 propose, we'll do it. We'll build a city so great that it'll be heaven on earth. And the city ended up empty, didn't it? God says, this isn't good. If they can do this, they'll think they can solve all of their problems when they really can't. And so it says God confused all of their language and they left the tower unfinished because they couldn't work together any longer. The people's labor is only fuel for the fire. God says all that we try apart from him gets burned up. But after it all gets burned up, here's what happens. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. How do the waters cover the sea? Completely, right? So much so that if there was no water over the sea, it wouldn't be the sea. It'd just be a hole in the ground. God's saying, this world that I am making is going to be the kind of place that is going to be filled with my presence so much that if you took it away, there wouldn't be a world left. And that's hopeful too. Because see, all the world has to stand silent before God because he is qualified. Because he is good, wise, powerful. He is everything that we need. When God frustrates the building of the Tower of Babel, God builds something else in its place. In the next chapter in Genesis, he calls Abraham and he says, "I am going to make you a blessing to the whole world." His construction project is to bless the people of the world if only they will have it.